If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 140 of A Life in Ruins podcast, where we investigate the careers and research of those living a life in ruins. I'm your host, Carlton Gover, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Connor Johnin and David Howe. Before we begin, listeners of A Life in Ruins podcast, we have heard you on Reddit and Instagram. And we are going to make some changes to the show. One, if you're listening, you probably noticed that our cover art has changed. That was voted on over a year ago, and we've done it. But that being said, so we went out to Reddit in mid-December, asked how we could help change the show. We got some constructive criticism from Redditors on r/archaeology. We also got just some pure fucking slander. So someone commented on the recent episode with just Connor and David and said that we had to use the N-word. We had not. We checked. Everyone checked. And the kid couldn't back himself up.
Nor was there one part of the where we would have said it.
Yeah. The whole thing was, it was just ridiculous. So then we decided to reach out to our followers on Instagram. Many of you also listen to the show and know us and aren't on Reddit. Big takeaways. One, less interview style episodes. We'll continue to do those. But you all wanted us to do more content, article, and recent events focused episodes. So that's what we have for you today, is more content in which that we've done background research, provide a more systematic episode.
Not to say that we won't be doing interviews anymore, but there were several, I guess, conversations about how like the meat of the interviews, like where it takes getting into segment one, then segment two, then finally the research, like maybe we'll condense that down a bit and just get right into the meat of it, I think was another thing.
Yeah. So we'll change those up a little bit. The other one is a big critique was for those that aren't archaeologists, early career in the CRM, that some of our episodes feel very much like you are at a partner's work party and you don't know what's going on. So we're going to do more to explain, define terms, theories, contexts, the content that we are talking about.
Yeah, there was one other thing. Oh, right. If you didn't see the Reddit post about our asking for criticism or what could we be doing better, we also posted it to Instagram. If you don't use either of those platforms, feel free to shoot us an email if you have any suggestions. We're not going to change like who we are. We're not going to post an episode that we don't find fun or entertaining, but we want to make sure it's accessible. We want you to be able to be like, hey, I know this podcast, and send it to my friends and not have to be like, well, I mean, skip 5 through 44 and get to 50, you know, to like do the episode. Like, we want you to be able to be proud of a podcast you can send to people. And if you do insinuate that we did a hate crime or of something of that nature, when we ask you to please provide a timestamp, please be able to say, oh, it's at this timestamp, and not that you can't bear to listen to it again. Because you made it up. don't do that.
That comment was fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not productive. We're generally looking for criticism and trying to better, because we want this podcast to evolve and grow. And that involves taking real looks at what we do and how we do it. And we want to be more accessible to everyone. But like everyone else said, we are not changing. We're still going to be ridiculous. That's the brand.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the brand. Dude, this is what you get. We're not changing that. We're just going to do our research a little bit more. So we're not going to, you know, we tried this more content and factually based stuff in the past, and we did it poorly with Revolutionary Boys 1, that we had to do a full second episode to correct what we said the first time. And that really burnt us out, probably because one, we hit the Revolutionary War, which a bunch of people really know about, and they grilled us, and we got kind of like, well, let's not do that again. So, but with this latest round of like really asking you guys, because the three of us have really gotten burnt out from this and fundamentally sometimes bored of the podcast, and we needed something to do, and we felt like,
because there's no feedback at all for us to know like how we're doing other than numbers.
Exactly. And our numbers have kind of stayed stagnant. And after listening to both Chris and Rachel's feedback on our annual review, Reddit and Instagram, and we've gotten plenty of emails and DMs, and it's been fantastic, the outpour of support. And the big one, more focused episodes that have research behind it. So today we're going to do one on probably the beginning of a little mini series on the history of archaeological thought and theory in an American context.
Which, if that sounds boring to you, is not. It's very fascinating, and it will help understand a lot more about archaeology.
Yes, exactly. Because the history of the field is pretty fun.
There's lots of racism, but you know, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, be prepared to be uncomfortable. Like, it's like, if you didn't know archaeology was a colonial field and has its deep roots in colonialism, it's not like physical anthropology, which is now bioanthropology. If you want to take a trip down holy shit lane, Let's just say like Hitler and the Third Reich were inspired by 1930s American physical anthropologists. Like, they were like, how do we do what they did to the Native Americans, but better? And hashtag that was the final solution. And those are uncomfortable.
They are uncomfortable. And if you're someone who is currently, and where I get this on TikTok and Instagram all the time, oh my God, another millennial talking about race, over bored, like they're not going to listen to this anymore. This is one of those times where it's like, okay, when we're talking about that kind of stuff, you might want to listen, because it's like where that comes from.
Our discipline was the one to identify that race is a social construct that has biological consequences, as we see with the enslavement and forced reproduction of American enslaved peoples.
I've seen on Paramount Plus in the new show.
What new show?
I haven't seen Yellowstone. I almost saw the prequel, but now there's a second prequel before Yellowstone with Harrison Ford in it.
Oh, and the 1920s one, yeah.
The first scene was just some indigenous girl being beaten by a nun, and I was like, yeah, I'm out. Like, you guys watch it.
That also happened as a consequence of some of these things. So like early American archaeology and anthropology is rife with colonial and racist doctrine. And the field has like 96% moved away from that.
Yeah, we got some stragglers.
There's some holdouts, people that will, they're the kind of people that are going to die typing on their desk and will be identified by the smell radiating out of their office. Like, those are the ones, like, once they're gone, you know.
Yeah.
But anyways.
One last thing I would like to say before we hop in. It was brought to our attention that I, and I guess by extent Connor in the episode that we were in which we did not use a racial slur, I say like entirely too much. And when I went and edited my presentation I gave the other day, I was like, man, if I drank every time I said like, I'd be blackout. So if you're drawing the car, if you're on the drive today driving, take a sip every time Carlton says like, every time Connor says like, and every time I say and says like, and you will be pretty caffeinated. If you're at home listening to this where you have an alcoholic beverage, I warn you, please be in your house, put your keys in a bowl, and strap in, because I'm trying to get better at it. But we will try.
Yes, I have found that when I take the Bob Kelly approach, where if I slow down and pause, I don't say my verbal crutches. But when I get worked up or my mind starts running, that's when comes out a lot more. As I told David and Connor, because we talked about this before, I had a professor, Dr. Gilbert, at Radford University, and I think it's the class was something 201, but it's one of those stupid welcome to college classes you have to take that aren't part of your major, and it was public speaking. This guy from New Orleans got polio before they had the vaccine, so he was in a wheelchair. Cool cat, spent most of his life as a lawyer. But this asshole had one of those like hotel reception bells on his wheelchair. And he Pavlov dogged the fuck out of us. The guy
from Breaking Bad.
Yeah. He, anytime someone used a verbal crutch, he would ring it. And for a very long time, when someone says that kind of stuff, they use verbal crutches. I heard it. And I wasn't really aware of how bad David said it until we got that comment. I listened to it. And now all I hear is when like it I do it.
Should be a Geneva Convention
problem. It was a war crime. What that man did was a crime against humanity for everyone in that class. And everyone from Radford had Professor Gilbert knew exactly what we're talking about. So we're going to move away from
it. I meant me on the last episode.
Oh, yes. No, that was a crime against humanity. If there was a Cards Against Humanity card, it'd be David's use of like. But to the archaeology. So as we mentioned, archaeology has its roots in colonialism. Particularly, we need to delve on back to a time of pigeon poop powdered wigs. Yes. You know, founding daddy kind of stuff, like way back when.
It's
Jay Brad. Jay Brad.
Founding Shout daddy. Out at it's Jay Brad. We got to get him on the show. anyway, archaeology.
So contextually, Europeans, Mediterranean folks have been exposed to each other for a long time and knew about existing cultures. There's a very much Judeo-Christian background to a lot of understanding of the differences between people across Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. As Europeans are finding a way to circumnavigate or circumvent the Silk Road and the holdings of people in the Middle East, China.
Circumvent by circumnavigating.
Yes. Circumvent by circumnavigating.
Title of the episode.
Yes. Europeans were trying to basically something to do with sailing, that there was a lot of line of sight, trying to keep the African coast in line. And if you lost sight of the coast, you're traveling south across paralleling Africa. If you don't make a pretty critical left turn, you're going to Antarctica and you ain't coming back. you're just gone. So some Portuguese dude was able to figure this out and get around Africa to the East Coast.
That was Bernal Diaz, right? Am I right in that?
I don't know. I should know because I just saw his monument in Portugal for the SHAs. And I got a whole...
Bernal Diaz was a Spanish conquistador, different guy.
I got a whole history of Portuguese exploration that wasn't...
Magellan. He circumnavigated. There's a person who did the Cape of Good Hope.
He didn't finish it. He died in Java or something like that, in Papua New Guinea.
Oh, he was eaten, I believe, in Tahiti.
he didn't make it home. The ship did and his crew did. He got the credit. Good for them.
Bartholomew Diaz. I was close.
Okay. And as they are coming in contact with cultures wildly different from themselves, they're trying to understand their place in the world, specifically in a Judeo-Christian context, the Bible, Genesis. They have Christopher Columbus, who is sailing 1492, the ocean blue, Hispaniola. The Europeans are kind of late to realize North and South America exist, as we're starting to learn now.
And the kid died thinking he was in Japan.
No, he went back a couple times. He figured it out.
Well, they were like, bro, this is Cuba. And he was like, no, this is Japan. These are some islands off Japan.
It was a whole deal.
Yeah.
They were trying to make sense of a lot of this stuff. So really, as Wiley and Sabloff, 1993, call it, this is the speculative period, which is like 1492 to 1840, in which everyone's trying to figure out Europe's place in the world and understand these global cultures and societies and how they fit to one another.
They're reconciling their worldviews essentially with what the new information that's coming out is, that they're interacting and seeing all these new things and they're like, what the fuck?
But the one thing that doesn't change, the Europeans are always on top. that never changes. They're just trying to rank everyone else below European society because they're like, we're the pinnacle. Where do all these other savages lie on the totem pole? Like, that's what they're trying to figure out. And so
that really doesn't change up until like the 19th, 20th century, which is
sad.
As Connor said, and what's important about this, these early expeditions are being funded by royalty, rich white guys who are going across the globe. Their worldview is coloring this aspect. And they're also coming in with the framework of trying to categorize people and cultures in relation to Europeans. So they're trying to figure out where everyone lies, what is a possible relationship. So that's where we start seeing instances of the Tower of Babel being used, which is a biblical event in which the Tower of Babel is broken, falls or something, and everyone gets a different language. These other people are the results of the lost tribe of Israel, the 13th tribe, or one that we see.
Kangaroos were just omitted from Noah's Ark.
Yes. Like, how did they? Penguins, what are those? As well as you also see things of like, well, black people are the children of Cain. Like, they're really trying to, in this sense, like, understand the world through the Bible, which doesn't work. And really, it's not until the 19th century, in the 1800s, when we have other fields of science becoming more institutionalized, we start seeing these other things. But one of the products of this antiquarianism, which are, they're not even archaeologists, it's what precedes archaeology, Antiquarians are the one people going across the globe pilfering things and bringing them back to Europe. For curiosity cabinets, which are basically just imagine a shelf in your house and rich white guys dude with stuff across the world. They bring people over.
British Museum has a super sick whole room of the museum that's just a curiosity cabinet.
Yes. They're smoking opium with their other rich white guy buddies and showing the cool stuff that they've collected.
I took this from a hunter in Papua New Guinea.
Yes.
He was saying something. I don't believe it was anything about God. So I shot him.
And took his things. So that's when we start seeing institutions in the 19th century, like the British Museum, the first culture-specific museums in Turin, Italy, which I just visited, and it's all about Egypt. Italy had a huge fascination with Egypt. Actually, in fact, when we talk about nationalism, which comes into play later, the Kingdom of Italy, the United Kingdom, fun fact, the United States has been a country longer than Italy has. They really tried to tie themselves to Egypt. Like the Holy Roman Empire, the czars, how everyone tried to tie themselves to Rome, the Italians try to do so through Egypt. And so there's a lot of that going on. But out of this, we get the fun Italian circus strongman, Balzoni, who is part of these excavations, ransacking of Egypt, in which he is instrumental in getting this very famous statue of Ramses II, Pharaoh Ramses II.
I think it's called a bust, technically.
A bust, yes, of the sand. And present for this event is Percy Shelley, who writes a very famous poem about the event, which is read by Bryan Cranston for the final season of Breaking Bad. Bob Kelly plays this in his intro to archaeology class at the University of Wyoming, and we have it for you now.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
Safe to say that was a bop.
That is a bop. I have it saved to my iPod. My iPod. iPhone. Jesus. Talking about archaeology. Yeah. All right.
Next segment.
My iPad mini. What was the little?
My iTouch.
Your shuffle?
My shuffle. Yes. No, my iTouch.
Man, I forgot about that.
Yeah, they were the precursors. So a lot of that's going on. It's not specific just to Egypt. This is when the Elgin marbles, well, really the Parthenon marbles are taken out of the Parthenon of Greece and brought to the British Museum. So this is really a time of not only of European intellectuals trying to understand the world around them and categorize cultures, but also bring a lot of these objects across the globe back for not really study, but really to show off. And it's a product of imperialism, fundamentally. It's a product of early antiquarianism is very much aligned with colonialism, imperialism, and a lot of other isms that make us very uncomfortable to learn about today.
And they're just the billionaires. My bad, you go.
And on that note, we will continue in the next segment talking about the 19th century, which gets a little better. We're making steps towards less colonialism and racism, but we're still kind of in that period. So we'll catch you in the next segment, episode 140 of A Life in Ruins podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
And welcome back to episode 140 of Life and Roots Podcast. We're going to pick right back off around the same time as the 19th century, right, which is the 1800s. There are some other issues that are popping up as they relate to colonialism and imperialism. So there's two case studies that we want to take a gander at real quick. We got to talk about Tommy J. Good old Thomas Jefferson.
Real TJ.
Quick. TJ.
So, inventor of the swivel chair, connoisseur of pimento cheese. Most ordered thing on his logs, pimento cheese.
Well, he also smuggled wine to, or grape seeds to America. That was a big no-no. And he smuggled them by, you know, like that, those like really poofy sleeve ends they used to have. He like unsewed them, threw a bunch of grape seeds in there, sewed it back up, and that's how he smuggled it.
American ingenuity. You know what they say? One World War II.
All of our founding daddies were pirates.
Founding daddies. It's J. Brad.
Founding daddy. So,
do you want me to just lay it out?
Lay it out, David.
So Thomas Jefferson, we can kind of consider him the father of American archaeology in a way, the founding daddy, excuse me, because he oversaw the excavation of mounds in his yard, essentially at Monticello. And he dissected those mounds and learned what they were. But was it him digging the mounds, Carl?
No. It was the enslaved people. Africans that he owned did that. So he oversaw it. Did he get dirty? No. The 6'4", socially awkward guy did not get his hands dirty. And the reason why this was done is, as we get to talk about colonialism again, as the states and Canada are being colonized by European powers, they're coming across monumental architecture in the form of earthen mounds. They don't know what they are. They think the contemporary indigenous populations, there's no way in hell they could move dirt to make piles of dirt. Just, it was well beyond their intellect. And so this is what we call the mound builder myth, in which this was used to justify, one, the extermination of American Indians, because they didn't, European colonists and Americans, Canadians did not believe American Indians could have done that. So they must have killed the people who did do it. The mound builders, the contemporary Native Americans must have killed them all. And if we kill them, it's fine. Also, no one knew how long the Americas had been occupied. The prevailing theory is, at this time, the Americas prior to European colonization, really, people hadn't been there longer than 1,000 years. So like really, like no one was there before 500 Common Era. TJ has his slaves systematically, that's the key word, systematically excavate the mounds to see the strata. And he was able to find European goods mixed with indigenous pottery and goods. And then he could see the context of cultural continuity between the outer layers, which had European stuff, to the inner layers, which had pre-European contact. And he was like, no, these are the same people. They made these. This wasn't too hard. Thomas Jefferson, everybody. He was able to systematically, first use of that we know of, a systematic excavation. Yeah. Now, that's not just to an American context. We have to throw the British under the bus again.
Do you think someone else did that before him too, but he was the only literate person to do it? And like, got it, or like, not, I shouldn't say literate, like person that had notoriety to get that published, I guess.
There's like a history of the Mormon church. Hold with me. Pilfering American Indian mounds was like a big business back in the day. So a lot of people used to do that and sell them as curiosities. And the founder of the Mormon church was a part of that in New England. Like that's his family did that for a long time. So systematically, I don't know. Like you said, TJ was one of the only ones to write it down, or one that we actually know who wrote it down. It might be in some library somewhere in, you know, Rockford, Connecticut, and we just don't know.
Yeah. But this also ties to like the larger world in general in science and things. So yeah, you're seeing Thomas Lyell publish on his principles of geology, where we're really starting to understand the laws of superposition and the idea that geologically things have been happening basically the same for millennia and years. So a lot of this stuff is all interconnected to this kind of expansion in science and understanding of things.
Enlightenment.
The quote unquote enlightenment. Yeah. So Lyell is like, law of superposition, geologic layers on top are younger than the ones on the bottom. Through a lot of that, we're exploring like, wow, you know, the Grand Canyon, that must be very fucking old for that to take place, because the same processes that happen today take place in the past. So we have Lyell doing that. We have Darwin figuring out in The Origin of Species. He's able to figure out one of the aspects of evolution, natural selection. He doesn't coin evolution. I think we've talked about that in a previous episode, haven't we?
Last word of the book is evolved, and that's it.
Yes, which I think that's
just pigeons.
And that's a later edition too. He uses the word evolution or evolved in like a third or fourth edition.
It's evolved, but then he got flack for it, so he changed it to breathed by the creator, or it was like originally breathed into a few forms or into one, but then he got flack for that, so he made it originally breathed by the creator into a few forms, a different one.
Yes.
So that's what it was.
So there's, in the sciences, we have all these different people in the 19th century, like figuring out all these different laws, realizing the age of the earth is much larger, much longer than a couple thousand years. And this idea that the earth is only 6,000 years old as prosthesized by some Christians, that's not in the Bible anywhere. I think it was like a monk, right? Like who did like some calculations that were clearly off, and he was like, well, Adam and Eve must have been around 6,000 years ago.
He didn't have enough RAM.
It was just not happening.
But also at this time is when we find Thomas Jefferson. This relates to the megafauna in France we were going to talk about.
Yes.
Thomas Jefferson, when Lewis and Clark set out to go west, was like, hey, there's these big bones, and they were sloth bones. And he's like, you might want to be careful, because this big creature like lives out there, and it's something we haven't seen before. But he understood it was something like larger, and I don't think he knew if it was like old or not.
So there's a couple things going on at the same time, right? So real quick, Americans weren't the only ones doing mountain builder debate kind of shit. The British came across the same thing at Great Zimbabwe, which is a site in East Africa, megalithic structure. They didn't believe that current African populations could have built those things, because at this time, Europeans are under this assumption that cultural evolution is just straight. Like, once you build something or you reach a certain technological level, you keep doing that, which is kind of weird, because that's what the Renaissance was about. This realization that the rise and fall of civilizations, right?
Yeah.
Reinforced by Sid Meier's.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So they're under this assumption that once you start doing monumental architecture, you don't go back to it. And they're also using a lot of this to justify. So they come across these great things, structures on the landscape or cultures in the past. Can't believe that the original people who are living in a different life way than what they see on the landscape, and say, well, they must have killed the old people, so it's okay for us to kill them because they've done it. So like, there's this really fucked up racial justification and colonial justification behind all this.
Do you want to delve into like the specifics of Tyler and Morgan and stuff like that?
Yeah, So when do they come up with that? So Taylor and Morgan, so around the same time in the 1800s, as people are coming across
new things.
So the sciences are like, in geology and biology, are coming across new things. Cultural anthropologists or earlier cultural anthropologists, ethnographers, are coming up with their own, like really social scientists are coming up with ways to classify and define people. So one of the early ones is by this guy named Thompson, who's Danish. He comes up with the 3-age system, the Stone Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age, and classifies groups into those. One of the more famous cultural and social forms of evolution are from
Lewis Henry Morgan.
And who's Taylor? What's Taylor's first name?
Bartholomew.
Edward Tyler.
Edward Tyler, yeah.
Both by Morgan and Bartholomew.
Thank you, David. They come up with savagery, barbarism, and civilization. That's where the terms savages and barbarians and the civilized folk come up with. Now, out of all these different social classifications that are presented, Europeans are always in the civilized folk. Like, they're the pinnacle. Like, there's no getting better. Yes. Who would have thought? Everybody else is below them, and they're trying to figure out, like, okay, where do these other people lie? So that's where a lot of these classifications of people come up. Like, there's this really, and if you look at like the history of anthropology, they're always trying to classify people. And usually there's like, they do the rule of three. It has to be three. But as the field develops professionally, as we continue to try to fucking classify things, there's never a one-size-fits-all rule, and the classifications keep... It looks like a crazy March Madness chart of classifications that just keeps getting bracketed, subcategorizations, and like the field is still like that today. Like if you look at modern archaeological taxonomy, it's a fucking mess that no one ever wants to tackle because we all just kind of use it and know like everything's a goddamn exception, but like no one wants to go to the work of redoing it like at all.
So it's really interesting because Thompson is focusing on his like stone, bronze, and iron age, specifically on Europe and those kind of areas. And there's not a lot of values assigned to these things. You know, the classifications are very simple. There's technological changes as people gain more technology. Tyler and Morgan specifically went to other countries and did ethnographies, and they come up with these very, very specific things to describe other people. So they use like savagery, barbarism, and civilization. So it's very value-laden because he's talking about these other cultures. And not just like the predecessors to Europeans. So there's always that underpinning of that racism that we're talking about.
So it's like not European A, or is it not European option C?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yes. It's
gotcha.
It's not great, but I'm going to argue that it maybe necessary is not the right term, but this is like the beginnings of trying to understand culture systematically. It's still very much done. It's a Eurocentric and ethnocentric worldview.
Yeah.
This is kind of like early scientific method because people continue to like reframe and criticize this technique to be broader, 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 broader. This is just the foundations of it. It's not fantastic, but it started somewhere, and that's where a lot of this social evolution starts from. And one of the big underpinnings of this, as I mentioned earlier, it's this form of social construct or social classification. It goes up. You start as a savage, you become a barbarian, and then you move to civilized. And there's no moving back or skipping a phase. It's very much you're going up.
Unilinear as the term for it. Yeah.
Which we know today is not true. And thinking about culture linearly is wrong. And so for our listeners, you just, as we'll get to in a later episode, when we talk about like modern day classifications, categorizations, or understanding of the breadth of human civilization and culture through time and space, there's a lot of ebb, flow, and movement between these different spaces. And like, what do they ultimately mean? Really, it's for archaeologists, the ability to, upon knowing what something generally falls into, the ability to understand what that classification means in terms of what you can expect to see in that culture. And then you still have to do the fine grained details. There's no one size fits all to this.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not as simple as evolution as we see in science. You know, it's not, humans are complicated and we don't evolve in one sort of way. So it's that the evolution part is slowly dropped as you get into it, because we aren't like that. I mean, we have evidence of people creating mounds, which is supposed to be like cities and being awesome, and then eventually switching out of that and going back to, you know, basic farming and things like that. It's just not the reality of the situation.
Right. Yeah. Human culture isn't Pokemon. Hey. Fundamentally, human culture ain't Pokemon. Yeah, it's not Pokemon. And as we see through time and space, it really isn't till like the organized state, when people can't not revert to something simpler. People throughout time and space that we've seen through the breadth of human history do not like being controlled. They fucking abhor taxes and do their best to avoid it. And if they can see a way to what we call now like voting with your feet, just leaving, people did that. Like, people don't like being told what to do. It's really not until like modern day that we can't just not do that.
Yeah. There's kind of a big shift that we see specifically attributed to Franz Boas, and we will talk about that in the beginning of the next segment. Welcome back to episode 140 of the Life in Ruins podcast. This segment, we're going to talk about Daddy Boas.
Papa Franz.
The father of American anthropology, or do you go archaeology?
I'd say anthropology.
He is the parent of of American anthropology. Papa Franz is what he's colloquially referred to in American anthropology, largely seen as the founder of American anthropology. He's the one that creates this four fields approach in anthropology. This is why archaeology in America is under anthropology and not history, which fundamentally separates us from the Limeys.
That's crazy. You see the apes? Do you know why that is, guys? Because I have the answer, or a answer.
Well, tell us, David. I'm actually curious. I don't know.
Yeah, Boaz. I actually want to hear your voice for once.
Boaz was one of those kind of like Einstein and Oppenheimer that came over later. That was because of the war. He was an immigrant. His family was like, yeah, it's probably, let's get out of Germany. And they came over here.
Emigrated from Germany, David.
Emigrated from Germany, right? So his family got here and he had a degree in physics, which I always find this fascinating. He had a degree in physics, or I believe a PhD in it. He might have got the PhD once he got here. But because of that, he had a scientific mind. And when he started doing anthropology and he was curious about indigenous American things, he applied that scientific method to understanding cultures. And it really separates Boaz and American anthropology from the rest of the world's archaeology kind of programs. It's not so antiquarian. It's not just collecting antiquities. He went to systematically study people. And I think that's why it's such a fundamental change, you know?
Yeah. And he goes out and studies with the Baffin Island Inuit and also worked with the cultures in the Pacific Northwest.
But he did get his doctorate in 1881 in physics, and he also studied geography. So that's the thing. Sorry, geography just to clarify. Too.
Okay.
No, he just studied it. He didn't get a degree in it. It's just maybe it was a minor. I don't know.
Okay, just cut that shit out. All right, so he studied with different indigenous groups and went out and did research. And the really important thing, his theory and his ideas that comes out of this is called historical particularism, which is in direct opposition to cultural evolution and these kind of larger theories that Tyler and Morgan had proposed.
I think it was cultural relativism.
Historical particularism is what Boaz was pretty much a proponent of. But he pushed for cultural relativism as well.
Yes.
And historical particularism is that each culture has its own intricacies and complexities to itself. It doesn't have to be related or evolved from another, I think is that's right. It's particular in its own sense.
And the only way to understand cultures is to study the history of that particular group. It's not a comparative thing.
Gotcha.
And that cultural values and the cultural relativism is cultural values are going to vary by specific groups and cultures. So he's just telling Tyler and Morgan to fuck off.
Yeah. He's saying with cultural relativism, he's like, everyone's special. Everyone's unique. Stop comparing everyone. You just need to take the context of this culture and see it for what it is, as it being off awesome on its own. Stop comparing it. He also is really big opponent of, what was that thing where you measured craniomorphology?
Oh, phrenology.
Yeah. So not only was he tackling archaeology with historical particularism, cultural anthropology with cultural relativism, but with physical anthropology, he was demonstrating hey, skull shape all is pretty malleable and is also dependent on diet and environment, that this is not a way, craniometrics or morphology is garbage. So Franz comes across the ocean and lives in the Americas, and he comes in with these backgrounds and is able to upend these long held notions, and he creates this four fields approach of anthropology and really utilizing archaeology as a way to study human culture in the past through its material remains rather than in a historical context. And he has some pretty amazing students that we'll get on in a later episode. So A.L. Kroeber, one of my colleagues is Kroeber's granddaughter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Max Kroeber?
I forget their name. I don't see them. They're not really in the office. Yeah. So we have one of their grandchildren, anthropologist here at Indiana University, Ruth Margaret Benedict, Mead. Sapir. Yeah. Margaret Mead.
Sapir of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which we'll get to.
Love the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, but
yeah,
some people don't. You might want to not say you love it.
Well, it's one of those things, I guess, to contextualize. There are some theories and materials that we learned in linguistic anthropology under Dr. Pamela Ennis that were just really tracked. And I really liked Sapir Whorf. I know there's issues with it, but it was also pretty, it was used somewhat in Arrival, right?
Yeah.
Well, and the cool thing is, and something we did as part of our intro to archaeology, I think, is we traced our heritage, and we've talked about this before, our academic heritage.
Yeah.
Yeah, our pedigree, which all eventually leads to Boaz.
All roads lead to Boaz.
All roads lead to Boaz.
So he's not a perfect character. He's a product of the 19th and 20th century. So there are some
closet of shrunken heads.
Yeah. There's we all got shrunken heads in our closets. It's just kind of,
he literally did.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's so we want to give him the credit he is due, but also be aware that everything he did was not perfect.
Right. It was 1875, you know. What can you do?
For the late 19th, early 20th centuries, his ideas about human culture, both past and present, were radically different than everyone else. Mm-hmm. And without him, you don't see the growth. Like, between him and 40 years, 50 years later, do we have a radical shift, and it shifts in the field. Without him, you know, prior to him, for like 200, 300 years, everyone's thinking relatively the same about Europeans are on top. He comes in as a European from Germany, where they produce white people, and is like, you know what, guys, this is not correct. That we need to appreciate and study cultures for what they are. It's cool to compare and contrast, but not in order of a rank-based system. And he passes that down to his students, who take that and continue to grow that. And really, if we look at these anthropological pedigrees, like your family tree, within three generations, the field is radically shifted from what he was thinking.
Absolutely.
You know, and over the breadth of, if you take a theory class in archaeology, things really ramp up post-World War II, especially after the horrors of World War II are seen across the globe. And it's a pretty rapid shift. Like, I think it's like damn near, what, every two decades there's a paradigm shift within archaeology. And now we're at a point where it's like, as we'll get onto this in a later episode, really prior to the 1990s, archaeological theory and anthropological theory is seen as like, that's your glasses frame of reference for how you see the world. Like, you apply everything you do through this theory. Whereas now, I'd argue, theory is a toolkit. Like, in order to answer the question you want to, you apply the theory that's going to help best suit that. Like, not everyone. Some people are still ardent Marxists, and that's all they do is like Marxist archaeology, and that's how they see the world is through means of production, the proletariat, bourgeoisie. Most of us are not like that.
Which applies to like large-scale societies and stuff. That's a great way to understand large-scale societies. You're talking about hunter-gatherers and Marxism?
You got to separate the trowel from the means of production.
Yeah. It depends on what you're doing and what your answers are.
Yeah.
If you're looking at energy production and consumption, cool, Marxist approach, that's probably going to help you more so than behavioral ecology.
And to Connor's point, behavioral ecology, when all you have is a few stone chips and some bone, behavioral ecology is all you kind of can go by, because there's no Marxism really in an egalitarian foraging band.
Yeah.
Yeah, at so least you can suss out from rocks.
One of the more interesting things that I've read recently, and this is not a tangent, The Dawn of Everything has a really actually very interesting, not critique, but perspective as to hunting and gathering societies.
Is that Dawood Hari, that author? No, that's Sapiens.
Yeah, it kind of talks about how the likelihood that there is a vast and complex difference between hunting and gathering populations, but we just can't see it, we never will, but just it like helped me, made me like rethink hunting and gathering populations more so than just the behavioral ecology approach. Can you prove it? No, but it's just fun read. It was just
that's Graeber and Wegenrow. Is that the one?
Yeah. Wegenrow.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Okay. I'll give it a look.
The first three chapters really dive into like the noble savage and some of these concepts that we were talking about, like the early case studies and events that led to social scientists talking about really being exposed to indigenous societies without kings and how they brought back to Europe was kind of this like catalyst for like the French Revolution. Others were like, wait a minute, there's people that don't have kings and queens and are doing just fine, better than ours.
Yeah.
We should be doing that. You know, like, so there's this really cool dialogue that talks about how really the being exposed to indigenous communities across the globe that did not have ranked societies challenged European worldviews of like, wait, this is what we were taught. Like, we can do this. Vive la Revolution. So it's a really interesting aspect. We're reading it at, for, I guess we have like an anthropology department reading club. It's like the whole department, we're all reading it. Yeah, I got roped into being one of the leaders of it. It's a fun time. It's been really cool to talk about. And they talk about the Ice Age. It's a fun time. For those that are for those that don't want to read Trigger, God forbid most archaeologists don't want to read Trigger or Wiley and Sabloff.
Or the primary sources where you get into Bordeaux or you get into some. So this book will probably be a good analog so you don't have to go through and suffer through Bordeaux.
Bordeaux or Foucault.
François Vaudil.
The goddamn French. Jesus.
It just doesn't translate. The translations don't.
They don't work.
Yeah, they don't they aren't readable to me. My brain's I can't get it. So there are really good textbooks out there. There's good books that we'll probably throw some in the description here and also links to what we've been looking at. So that's kind of, I think, I don't know, on a future episode we'll get into the students of Boaz, which are also very interesting and very fun. And you can
We should end real quick with what are the four fields real quick so we can leave people with the product of what we talked about today.
Archaeology, what was physical anthropology, now it's called biological anthropology, linguistic anthropology, and cultural anthropology. Those are the four fields, four primary fields that make up anthropology. Each one has its own subcategories that go on forever. And a lot of them overlap more so than you would think. How do linguistic anth and archaeology overlap? They do. That's the beauty of our four fields approach is that we all have degrees in anthropology. We are anthropologists first. I really have to say, like, the University of Wyoming's four field approach is like one of the better four fields programs. They really, you leave with a master's from Wyoming, you're a four fields anthropologist. Like,
yeah, I'm 100% a proponent of that because they shouldn't be isolated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something you'll see overlap in everything. And it's, to understand humans, you have to understand all four of those aspects.
Yeah, which includes our evolution, primatology, and biological anthropology, anatomy, osteology. Then you get into linguistics, which is how you use language, not just how they develop. Cultures can be anything. Archaeology can be anything. And then, you learn a lot. It's like you plug into the Matrix for like 2 years in grad school and you're like, well, I can't look at anything the same again.
Yeah, and we've mentioned that on previous podcasts, is that once you put this filter on your brain, you think of things through anthropological lenses from here on out. It's never the same.
I can hear Tucker Carlson like shitting his pants right now, thinking that's the liberal agenda at work. Jesus, but
when I saw that Taco Bell commercial from a year ago, when it was like they were like Power Rangers or something defending their Mexican spices against monsters, I just wanted to fucking cry. Whoa. At that aspect of it. I know I bitched about this on an episode before, but like, yeah, you get a degree in anthropology, you're going to suddenly hate most media that's present because you're like, well, that's fucked up. Well, that's racist.
Why is every woman in a cleaning commercial cleaning and sitting down on the floor?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It changes it for the better, I would argue.
I would 100% agree. I think it's, you get some truth and as much truth as you can in this fucked up world we live in.
And surprisingly, some people can go through like grad school in anthropology and still like be closed-minded.
A piece of shit.
People. I went to school with a person that got their degree in physical anthropology and still did not believe in evolution.
Wow.
Crazy.
And on that note, thank you for listening to us. Please leave us comments, send us emails. We want to know how we are doing and we want to get better. We want to, for you guys not to suffer through this. So thank you for listening to us and we appreciate all of you.
And if you're still listening to the show on the All Shows feed, please switch over, subscribe to our show individually. It helps us grow our platform. You guys have been doing better. I'm going to tell you, I can look at the numbers and you guys are switching to our show. It's fantastic. Keep doing that, please. It helps us.
Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast on Instagram, Facebook. It's just a Life and Ruins podcast. Twitter, I think it's a Life and Ruins pod. And if you don't mind, oh, text from Stefan Milo.
How's Stefan doing?
Just had a second baby. He's scheduled interviews for Portland. Anyway, SAAs will be at Portland, Oregon this year. I will be going. I don't know about you, Carlton or Connor. I think you're going.
Yes.
Yeah, Carlton has to go. So we will... we'll see you guys there. We can't really do a booth because that's like fucking $2,000 to do. But if you guys want to fundraise us to do a booth, we could do a Life Ruins booth. If you don't want to, we'll see you at a bar. And on that note, yeah, please be sure to rate and review the podcast. The reviews only help us grow. And if you want to give us a straight up roasting in our emails about what you think, or not roasting, but you know, what you think we could do better or some things that you would like to
constructive.
See. That's the word.
Do yep. The compliment sandwich. Hey, love your show. David needs to stop saying like. However, I like these kind of episodes, you know.
Yeah, and we just got a really good email recently about that, and it helped us to make sure that we are being more inclusive with our audience. So
because we don't get paid, if we can fucking quit this whenever we want.
Yeah, so, but we want for your sure, criticism. Guys, we do not make any money off this.
Yeah, like no, we're this is
minus
this is
money,
minus money, so much minus money and time,
a lot.
So like, if you're gonna give us criticism, we want it, but like. Give us a reason to quit.
Yeah. Like roast us.
Yeah,
I did get an email or a Facebook message from somebody about we needed to cover more CRM and have more CRM people on here because that is 90% of archaeology and that is a very fair statement. So we will do that.
Yeah. And with that note, we are out.
Thanks for listening to a Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at A Life in Ruins Podcast, and you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer.
And as always, if you were able to make it to this part, you know what time it is. It is time for Connor's witty joke.
What hit serotonin them. Do you have for us today?
Hit that macho man.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah!
Did you hear about the kidnapping at school?
Oh, Jesus. How long was he asleep for, Connor?
It's okay, he woke up.
Yep, that's what I thought.
Fuck off. We're doing another one. Why do nurses like red crayons?
I don't know, Connor.
Because sometimes they have to draw blood.
Oh, that's pretty good.
That was good. I like that. That was the same.
All right, I gotta go to bed because I got PT in the morning. I thought we were done.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.